The following program is a production of NDS Entertainment. Welcome to a Nate Darling Show special, Tate, Tate, with Nate. One in a series of conversations between Nate and people he finds interesting. Now, a man with no turntables and a microphone, Nate Darling.
Yeah, turntables? Those are like old school. I don't even have any vinyl on me.
I would have thought you would have had turntables here.
Nah, no need for turntables. So this is a little side project I've got going. It's a bonus for any subscribers to the Nate Darling Show. This is, as you heard in the computerized introduction, something I'm calling, at least for now, Tate-a-Tate with Nate.
That's genius, by the way.
Because it does rhyme. And hey, if it rhymes, it must be good.
Yeah.
For those of you who don't speak French, it translates to head-to-head. So with me for the very first episode of this little endeavor is my friend and filmmaker, Chris King.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Thanks for joining me in the living room studio. Mm-hmm. Me and the kitten, Ace, are very happy to have you.
Love Ace. Good-looking cat.
He's a good guy. He's a good guy. So let's start at the beginning with you, Chris. You had to share a womb as a fetus. How was that for you?
You're asking me to recall?
Well, if you can. Just whatever you can remember is fine.
I can't recall at all.
But, okay.
With the person who I shared it with turned out to be a challenge later on, though.
That's
a long story that you've heard.
I have heard. That may be for some sort of bonus thing down the road or something that your family can, you know, never, ever hear, at least going out to the public. I kid, though. You grew up in Washington State. I actually grew up all over, correct?
All over the place. Arizona, Iowa, Missouri, Washington State, California.
So if someone were to pin you down and say and tickle you and say, Chris, where are you from? What would you tell them?
I say Pasco, Washington.
There you go.
That's the longest amount of time, you know, the junior high school, real formative years. So,
and how many brothers, sisters?
Five. I'm hemming and hawing on answering that question because I have a stepbrother named Ernest. So
okay.
Five brothers, one sister.
And is that counting Ernest?
That's counting Ernest.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were there a lot of Ernest goes here jokes in the 80s when Jim Varney was big?
Didn't exist back in that day.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
He didn't, or the...
The movies.
Okay.
Didn't exist back then. So he didn't get any chatting from us for that.
So you grew up, went to school, went through the whole thing. And when did you decide, I want to be a filmmaker? Because one of the things that people who know you for best is making independent films. When did you decide that that's something I want to get into?
Wow, specifically film. Good. You know what? It was actually when I started screenwriting, and I started screenwriting in 1995 definitively after the OJ verdict. I'm not going to say what side I came down on that verdict, guilty as hell. But after that, I was so angry. I, for some reason, just put pen to paper, and I started trying to write a screenplay because I had heard about this guy that everybody has now beaten to death in terms of trying to emulate, and that's Tarantino. Mm-hmm. Tarantino was the 94, 95 when Pulp Fiction came out. And for some reason, because of that verdict, I was just so angry about something, and I just started writing. I know... How does A lead to B? I don't know. All I can tell you is that's what happened. Just started writing, but in terms of film making...
Now, let me stop you right there.
Yeah.
So that's when you started putting pen to paper. What were you doing at that point in your life?
Just working as a banquet waiter down in Southern California with a girlfriend at the time, now wife Heather. And... really, you know, no kids yet, and just kind of having fun in California and making some money, and that was it. Studying screenwriting.
Okay. So it was something, it wasn't just like out of the blue, suddenly you're,
right.
you come home from a night of waiting tables at the big banquet hall for some Shriners convention or something, and you're
right.
like, you know what, I'm going to write like Tarantino. Now, there was something more going on. You were already studying it.
Exactly. And when I started studying screenwriting, screenplay format, boy, I just got... I'm an all-or-nothing kind of a guy. And when I do, I go full bore ahead, and I grab every book that I can on screenwriting, how to do it, all the, you know, how do the masters handle it, etc. So that's how I got into screenwriting, which then led into the interest of film.
Now, your first film that you made was a full-length feature,
right?
Correct?
Right.
How was that experience overall for you?
I'm so glad that I was so naive at the time when I did it, or else I wouldn't have done it. I hadn't made a film at the time, was done with film school, and just wanted to put one of my screenplays that I'd written, you know, into action, because, you know, I'd had an agent for a couple of years in LA just trying to sell some of my own scripts, and it wasn't working. I'm certainly wasn't alone in that respect, and just thought I'd, you know, roll the sleeves up with wife Heather and try to make a indie film. So we did.
And the overall experience of that, and I know you said it was better to be a little naive going into
right.
it. What would you say to somebody who is thinking along those same lines now? If, let's say, I came to you and I'm like, I got some ideas, I've got a full length feature here that I'd like to do, mm-hmm. but I've got some other smaller ideas that, you know, but I want to go in full bore. What would you say to that person?
I would completely steer them in the opposite direction, because I did it in the opposite way. I did a feature first and then I did shorts, which is the opposite of what you're supposed to do. Only because I hadn't written any shorts before. I hadn't really thought of the short film format. So all I'd ever done were feature length scripts. So, you know, why not? So my advice, you know, yeah, it would definitely be no, you know, do some short films first, you know, work on your craft of A, storytelling, of course, and B, you know, just a visualistic style, and just get better and just more sophisticated in terms of shot selections and again, story,
mm-hmm.
you know, important story as well.
So when you attack a project, do you get a story idea first? Do you have a character idea? Or does it vary from project to project?
Project to project. I'm a big drama fan. Wish I could do comedy. Comedy is so difficult.
Tell me about it.
And so and so underrated. You know, I've had some funny ideas, and again, wish I could do comedy, but it's just too difficult, and man's got to know his limitations.
There you go.
And I know mine. But to answer your question, though, drama, I just get a lot of my ideas off the tube. I've been a TV junkie since I was a kid, and I watch a lot of that dramatic shit, like Discover ID and all those, you know, hardcore true crime dramas, and there's wonderful material in those.
Now, you mentioned your wife, Heather,
yeah.
who's lovely, by the way.
Thank you.
In a lot of ways, she's really a very sweet person and also a very pretty lady. She's your partner in Watermark Films.
Right.
How does that partnership sort of work out? Is she the designated no person, or is she the designated you go for it, let's do it?
She's both. She's the designated no person in a couple ways. She's a wonderful editor for me. I've always said this, you know, and I'm sure I'm not the first, you know, if I want to get patted on the back for how wonderful a writer I am, I'll send my script to my mom.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know the deal with moms. They'll just, you know, oh my gosh, I love... You're having a good time with the cat over there.
The cat bit my thumb.
Okay. But wife Heather is... She is a terrific editor. And she doesn't mess around when it comes to my stories or when it comes to seeing cliche or melodrama or combinations in my writing. Because we fight, you know, with something that you fight with. Against cliche and the bullshit that you see in movies and TV that you've seen a million times. And so she won't pull any punches. Is that the expression? Pull any punches when it comes to reading my scripts and you know, giving me the, you know, kudos on, hey, terrific, ooh, awesome segment here. While at the same time on page 2, 3, or 4, whatever. Oh my God, what were you thinking there?
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So she's sort of the voice of reason.
Absolutely.
When it comes to projects.
Yeah, and I don't, and I want her to be completely honest, because you're just not going to get any better with someone who A, is either kissing your ass, you know, and is just telling you what you want to hear. Oh my God, you're wonderful, amazing writing. But no, I'm not going to get any better hearing that. I appreciate that. I'm not a dick. you know, I appreciate the sentiments, but it's all about improving.
Now, that being said, yeah. If you see Chris at a festival or a Q&A or something like that, that doesn't mean he wants you to come up to him and give him critiques on his writing.
Right.
He's perfectly happy for you to come up and go, listen, man, I really enjoyed your last film.
Your Q&A after a film. You know what, Chris? Act three really needed some work. And here's some ways I can help.
What were you thinking there? Right. Oh, my God.
Right.
Which I've been lucky enough, because you and I work together and in the day jobs, to see a couple of your scripts before they were made. And mm-hmm. I recall one in particular that it's a completed project now, that you showed me the script and I was like, well, it's good, but I have a question as to the motivation of this character.
Which one was this? Proposal?
Yes. Mary Surratt? It was Proposal. Okay. And you very nicely said to me, well, I see what you're saying, but I don't know. I don't see that at all. And it was very rewarding for me as a person later on, not as a person, but just overall, that once you ran the idea out there to a few other people that you respect, and they came back with basically the same question I did, that you were like, and you came back to me and you were like, you know what? That thing you said, I didn't see it, but other people did. And so I guess you were right. So I think that speaks very highly of you as a not just a creative person, but somebody who's able to take that feedback and not just be dismissive of it.
Absolutely, thank you for saying so. And I'm glad I'm mature enough.
Well, those things always come
by
with
my
time.
Age, yeah, with age. To hear that, because when it's a situation and you did jolt my memory there. Yeah, I do remember that when enough people are saying to you, Chris, that's not an airplane over there, that's a car. If enough people are telling you that, then damn it, it can't be a car. And that's the same situation with, you know, screenwriting or just filmmaking. You have to listen to reason, but at the same time, you can always not take that mm-hmm. comment or that bit of advice. And like, for instance, we did a screening of Proposal about 4 or 5 months ago. In front of one of the film groups here in town, and nice comments afterwards. You know, a lot of cool handshaking and attaboys and all that. And then I remember this one person who was just very sure of himself when he said to me and Heather, "By the way, during the film, you really need some music throughout the course of that dialogue. Otherwise, man, we're just kind of sitting there with two people talking in dialogue."
Uh-huh.
And I remember that's one of those perfect examples of quote unquote comments that you just kind of respectfully, politely rather, shake your head and nod and go, yeah, that's something to consider. That's something to think about, even though there's no way in hell I'm going to muddy a really intense conversation with melodramatic music in the background, just for the sake of having music. You know what I mean? So you can always not take comments.
Of course.
Yeah.
But I think the real lesson to be taken away from this is just listen to me to begin with and save yourself a lot of time in the end.
Thank you.
That's the way I go about life. And I keep telling people that, but people don't listen until they have to come back and go, you know what? You were right.
Okay, to-do list. First thing, run all scripts by Nate first.
Sure. I'll read them if I have time. Yeah. So you've done how many films have you completed at this point? I know you're in the middle of doing a trilogy of short films. So how many completed films do you have, not counting the ones that you have in production and planning now?
7 films, first one feature, the last 6 shorts. And pretty much just doing shorts. I mean, when you work full time and you got 2 kids, I don't have time or the luxury to do feature length films. And if I do ever get the a script, whether it's written by me or someone else, you know, it doesn't have to be my precious words. No, if there's a terrific project out there, property, feature length, I'll admit I do look forward to that day where, you know, 90 pages is sitting in front of me and I'm like, oh my God, Heather, stop everything. We are shooting this sucker. Because I've pretty much made up my mind, you know, I'm sure because of my age and where I am in life, I won't do a feature unless I know it's going to be memorable,
mm-hmm.
relative a term, as you can, as you know, what the hell does memorable mean? Meaning, I don't want to just show here in Sacramento and a few film festivals and then it's dead. There's $50,000 to $500,000 down the toilet. That's a lot of people's money, you know, being pumped into films. And so what do I mean by memorable? I certainly wanted to... going to a theater would be lovely. That'd be wonderful, sure. But DVD and having some very critical legs, you know, underneath it, that's some word of mouth. It's, you know, holy cow, look what this nobody so-and-so, you know, husband and wife team from Rockland did. That's what I'm talking about.
And to get a look at all of your projects, you have a website, watermarkfilms.net, correct? You can take a look at all the stuff. Do you, and I haven't been on the site in a while, do you have trailers and things for your films on there?
You bet. Trailers, you know, cast and stories and biographies and, yeah, a lot of information on the various films we've done and, yeah, and that we're about to be doing.
Yeah, so it's a great way if you're curious, you know, what's Chris doing, what's he been doing, and that's just a good way to find out, watermarkfilms.net. And like I said, the trilogy that you're shooting now, and I know you have one that's completely shot, and then you have the next two that you have coming up. Can you tell us anything about those?
Sure. The first one is called Happiness, and since we traditionally deal in so much drama, it's certainly, as you can expect, it's the opposite of happiness. And it just sort of, going back to your earlier question, you know, how do you get your ideas sometimes? And they do. They vary. This particular film idea came when I was, you know, at work with you one day, and I was thinking about a gal in the copy room in sales, and a guy enters and they start making out. Sometimes that's just where an idea comes from. Okay, why are they making out? And I just started exploring the idea of just this hugely passionate, wonderful scene, really, where you're almost kind of rooting for these two people who you don't really know, but they just seem very sweet together. And anyway, getting towards the end of that, makeout session, and they're busted by somebody who walks in. Who is it? I don't know. This is just how this beginnings of ideas come from. Anyway, they get busted. She walks out. It's the end of the workday. She leaves, walks out of the building, and gets into the car of her awaiting husband and two children. Okay, why? And so that's where that idea came from. Random that it is.
To be fair, that didn't actually happen as it played out at work, just in case anybody's wondering.
Yeah, right.
Because people hear stuff like that, and y'all, I had this germination of an idea that came from here, and then they immediately want to go, well, who was it? What was going on? Because they assume that it actually happened, and it that wasn't it at all. It was just, that was the spark
of inspiration, Chris, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
No.
I'd be remiss in my duties as a talk show host if I didn't ask you about the thing that, and I know you've been asked about this a billion times now. You were a copywriter or a puzzle writer on Wheel of Fortune for a time.
Right. Someone has to do it, Nate.
No. I understand that. so working in a situation like that on a very well-known TV show where you're around incredibly... At the time you were there, Wheel of Fortune was absolutely huge. One could argue at the peak of its popularity, due largely to your puzzles.
Thank you very much. I'm sure that's what it was.
It was that, exactly. How was it working on the Sony lot with Pat Sajak and Vanna White?
It was awesome. You know, when you're going through film school, the last thing in your mind where you're going to be working is a game show. Not that you're all hoity-toity when you're in your college days going through film school. You're just so immersed in film.
Well, a lot of people are hoity-toity.
Yeah, you know what? That's a good point. A lot of people are, but I'm not. But you know, all I needed was three units for three final units, you know, for my requirements at Cal State Long Beach, where I was going to film school. And so I'm applying to Sony and Miramax, Universal, etc., and I just can't get in anywhere. And so, you know what? My wife Heather's friend of a friend knew somebody at Wheel of Fortune over on the Sony Pictures lot. And I'm like, oh, God. You know what? For the sake of just getting these three credits underway, sure. So anyway, I went there. said hello to them. Yeah, sure, you can intern with us for the semester. So I did. That's how I got onto Wheel of Fortune. And after working there as an intern, I quickly realized what a cash cow Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy is. Holy cow. I mean, millions and millions of dollars they make globally every year, you know, from all the various countries that, you know, have purchased the rights to be able to do their own versions of Wheel of Fortune.
Right.
Yeah. And so just an enormous cash cow for them. And they, you know, have the best offices and the best section of Sony Pictures Entertainment. And I'm like, God, I had no idea. For the purposes of employment, et cetera, you know, I got hired on as a PA. A 35-year-old PA, because I'd done the whole military thing and started mm-hmm. college later. But it was a terrific and fun time at Wheel of Fortune. It was 5 years, but it was a huge burnout situation too. I mean, I quickly went from a production assistant to the writer of the puzzles of Wheel, and there had only been one writer in the 20 years that preceded me of the puzzles and the promotions, you know, when Pat and Vanna do commercials.
Mm-hmm.
Someone's got to write that copy. There had only been one. And when that opportunity came on, when she quit and they offered me the job, I'm like, oh my God, sure, happy to. A lot of cool perks, a lot of good fun. Vanna is exactly what you think she is, an absolute Southern Belle doll. Pat's extremely intelligent, sometimes ornery cuss, but he's a very nice guy. I never had a problem with Pat. And in fact, we had some very funny off-color conversations. And he's, yeah, a funny guy. Good experience at Wheel of Fortune, but high burnout rate. And I'm so glad I ended my days there and went on to writing, producing, directing, shooting, editing,
mm-hmm.
you know, commercial stuff to just improve my own resume.
And how long were you the puzzle writer at Wheel?
I was there for 5.5 years. I was writing for the puzzles for the last three.
Yeah, that is a lot. I mean, when you sit and watch Wheel of Fortune and you go, oh, that's easy, go ahead and try and do it yourself. You were telling me about it, yeah. About how it happens.
Yeah.
And just as an exercise, watch Wheel of Fortune, record Wheel of Fortune, and sit down and watch it and count the number of puzzles and do that. And then do that 5 times, and then do that another 4 times, and that's a month. And then you've got to keep doing it. And you guys shoot, they shoot multiple shows in a day, correct?
Multiple shows in a day. And the most maddening part, you know, it's Wheel of Fortune puzzles. How tough can they be? You know, it's the whole, you're not doing Jeopardy, Chris. Yeah, true. No, but I oftentimes wish that I had been doing Jeopardy puzzles, because there's a lot more leeway with Jeopardy. And I know you've heard me talk about this before with regard to Wheel of Fortune puzzles. The maddening part about it was not being able to use so many puzzles that you come up with.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, Wheel of Fortune being on the air for 20 years that it has, there's a database of puzzles that have been used. Every time I come up with a puzzle, I type it into the database. Boop. It's been used before. Not only has it been used before, it's been used 5 times over before. Come up with something new. That's my job. I don't mm-hmm. get paid to, you know, recycle old you know, puzzles. So it was maddening to A, try to come up with new puzzles, and B, come up with politically correct puzzles, because
it's a family show.
PC show Wheel of Fortune is, my gosh, yeah. So it was a constant rejection of puzzles, only to finally come up with the ones that would finally pass through.
Yeah, you can't go, oh, it's a 5-letter word
yeah.
thing, and it can't be dildo. that will not.
Oh, though I wish it could be.
I know.
Yeah, we oftentimes, me, Pat, and Vanna, behind the puzzle board during taping sessions, would oftentimes talk about the HBO version of Wheel of Fortune if we had it.
That would be funny. Oh, so yeah. Pat and Vanna, great. Alex Trebek, giant tool. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know.
I never had a problem with Pat, Alex either.
And did you get to interact with Alex a lot? I know the studios are right next to each other.
Yeah, the offices literally of Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy are right there on the same floor. I mean, mm-hmm. just everybody's together. And Alex is, I always thought was a terrific guy. I didn't work with him intimately, constantly on a daily basis, but by the nature of Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy being, you know, brother and sister shows, 1 and 2, in terms of the ratings, a lot of the times you just, yeah, I worked on Jeopardy We even went on the road with him several times, and he was always a nice guy and very generous come Christmas time.
Yeah, just stay out of his hotel room in the middle of the night, because he will chase you out of there, even at age 72 or however old he is. Google it if you don't know what I'm talking about. So let's get back to filmmaking a little bit. I just had to do that little aside because it's a kooky
side note to one's career.
It's a very interesting thing, and it's always cool for parties. And I know you're probably tired of talking about it, but people don't get tired of hearing about it. So getting back to your films, I know your films are all like children, but I'm going to ask you to pick your favorite child. Which one do you like better, the older one or the... No, I'm just kidding. Which one of your films do you, I don't know, identify with the most, or just... let's say your favorite film.
Okay, I'm not going to... You know, everybody oftentimes will give a bullshit answer, you know, that politically correct answer. Like you said, my children. Oh, they're all equally... I'm not going to give you that one. I do have a favorite. And it's Rachel.
Mm-hmm.
And Rachel's a short film that we did about, 5 years ago already. About this gal, again, another idea that I got off of one of those PM news programs, you know, Discovery Channel or what have you, of the true crimes. It's of this gal who was going from state to state contacting other couples under the pretense that she was pregnant and she could give up her child to them, these wanting, you know, the parents, you know, who are wanting these children. So they hook up through an online, you know, situation. I have a baby. I'm going to give birth here. Happy to give it to you guys. I'm not financially able to do it. So she ran a scam thing there, and it was horrible. And I never forgot about that documentary about this gal. It was just so haunting because she was so cold-blooded. And she would say things to these unsuspecting couples in their living room like, you know, I'm so happy for you guys and, you know, getting this baby. And it's, you know, it's a little thing I can do is to give you your baby to you. And, you know, but if you could be there to cut the cord, I think that would be a really wonderful thing. You know, to bind you, that kind of stuff.
So she's pulling them into this more emotionally.
Brutal, brutal.
So it's this huge emotional investment that these couples are getting more and more and more into, into this character, into, oh my God, we're finally able to have our own baby, and we're finally going to be able to adopt one. Not only are we going to be able to adopt one, we're going to get a baby, and we're going to get to cut the cord.
Right.
And
during this whole time, the whole scam that's, you know, comes about as a result of this whole relationship that she develops with them, is that she accumulates what I call sympathy money over time. You know what I mean? During this process, you know, I could use some help with rent or whatever. And these couples, you know, are so willing and happy to have this child. They send thousands in the mail to this gal, who then cashes them and go on spending sprees with her friend. And it's just all one big joke to her. But anyway, I just always remembered that story. And I just put pen to paper with that, like I do, you know, created my own scenario so that I don't get sued.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's most fun with me, is taking a real scenario, a real life true story, creating my own situation, characters, names, dialogue, etc., giving it perhaps a double entendre, where either the title or the meaning, et cetera, or both are concerned, and just having fun with it and the aha moment that short films will oftentimes have. And I think I'm so pleased, and because so many people have been pleased with Rachel. It was such an inexpensive film to do. It's shot over 2 days. Locally in Rockland, Heather and I just literally had no money to spend on film and equipment, etc. So we essentially fed people. That was our big expense.
Right.
I think it was like $600 worth of food. And we cast this gal, a nobody from Humboldt, who had done maybe a community theater play in her past, as opposed to, you know, whenever we held an audition session, we always have a sort of a unwritten policy that Heather and I do. We'll let like two or three complete unknowns with no experience come in and audition so they can get experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so this gal comes in, you know, she had no headshot to speak of, and she comes in and blows us away. Unbelievable. Kelly Nixon is her name, and amazing performance. Now, anybody can get lucky on an audition day, which is why we'll oftentimes do callbacks.
Mm-hmm.
So she came back, did it again with a whole different passage, and we're like, oh my, okay, you got it. You have the job. We shot it, did it, edited it, and it turned into something very special. It's by far, I think, the most critically and globally, I want to be careful using that, successful short film that we've ever done. It was only one of 10 short films chosen in the world at the Manhattan Short Film Festival. One film represents a country, so it was just a huge honor,
mm-hmm.
you know, to be representing the United States with this short film with Rachel. With a film that only cost $600 to make, so that's one's very dear to our hearts, though we love them all.
Now, on the other end of the spectrum in terms of cost and scale of production, the one that a lot of people sort of came to know you for a number of reasons, was The Killing of Mary Surratt,
right.
which, for anybody who doesn't know, she was convicted as a co-conspirator in the Lincoln assassination because she met John Wilkes Booth once. she was an innkeeper. And that film is available at Ford's Theater in D.C.
Ford's Theater in D.C. at the Mary Surratt Museum in Maryland, on Amazon, on our own website, on Shorts HD International.
It is available in all those places, but I find it cool that the place that the place that is sort of the tourist attraction for people who are studying up and are real buffs on Lincoln, the fact that they are like, this film is so good that we want to have it here for people to be able to take home. I think that's a huge compliment. And the other part of that was about a year or so ago, Robert Redford had a much bigger budget and did a full-length
just
feature.
Just a little bit.
A full-length feature called The Conspirator, or Conspirators, I don't know which, because not very many people saw it. It was not very well reviewed critically. And in fact, the San Francisco Chronicle reviewer, in his review of The Conspirator, pointed out how much better a job you did in a short film of covering the same subject.
Which doesn't suck.
No, that's absolutely fantastic. So, yeah. I think that's a good place to leave off. I mean, big compliment. I want to thank you for coming in.
You bet. Happy to be here.
So, Chris King, independent filmmaker based in Sacramento area, Rockland, California. The website is watermarkfilms.net. He has a wonderful wife, Heather, who's his partner. And wife. Not, I don't want to go. When you say partner, it sounds like this weird. Sounds like this weird thing. Yeah. No, they're official. It's real. I've seen the rings. It's all okay. So thank you for coming in and joining me. I really appreciate it. And
June 9th, we're having that situation. We're having that entertainment fair at Studio 24. Come say hi.
In Sacramento. So if you're in Sacramento and you're hearing this before then, come on out and say hello to Chris and Heather and see what's going on with them. In the meantime,
love that rock and music.
I know.
Exit now.
Gotta leave a little bit of music because it's still a fun podcast.
Right.
We're gonna have more people in to do this sort of thing as a bonus to all Nate Darling Show listeners. So if you like it, let us know, and we'll catch you down the road. Have a good day, everybody. One Prozac a day. Husband's a CPA. Her dreams went out the door when she turned 24. With one man, what happened to her plan? She was gonna be an actress, she was gonna be a star, she was gonna shake her ass on the hood of Whitesnake's car. Her yellow SUV is now the enemy. Looks at her average life, and nothing has been alright since Bruce Springsteen, Madonna. Way before Nirvana, there was YouTube and Blondie, and music still on MTV. Her two kids. We'll be right back.
and bring back Springsteen, Madonna. Way before Nirvana, there was U2 and Blondie. Music still on MTV. Her two kids in high school, they tell her that she's uncool, cause she's still preoccupied. 1985, Springsteen, Madonna. Way before Nirvana, there was U2 and Blondie. Music still on MTV. Her two kids in high school, they tell her that she's uncool, cause she's still preoccupied. 1985.